All right. Well, thanks very much, all of you, for attending. The few, the proud, the attendees of this session up against Al Gore on a beautiful day, also up against Happy Hour, which I bet is outdrawing Al Gore by about 2-1, and us about 6,000 to 6 or so. But anyway, we will give you a great talk anyway for making the trek all the way up the stairs, on the shuttle bus, to the third floor, et cetera. So I'm Dan Stanzione, and this is Matt Vaughn, and we both work here at the University of Texas at Austin at the Texas Advanced Computing Center. And we want to talk to you about the iPlant project today and how we're using supercomputing to help feed the world. And so really, we're going to do this talk in four very quick sections that I'm going to do some of and Matt's going to do some of. And the particular sections are, first, we're going to tell you a little bit about the background of the Texas Advanced Computing Center, because we don't get to show off in front of this audience very much, except for the three of you that work there. But for everyone else, this is our first chance at South By, or one of the few chances at South By we have to tell you a little bit about the center. And then we're going to talk a little bit, just sort of motivating this, why we at a supercomputing center, and frankly everyone else, ought to care about the future of plants, and why that's become a computing problem. And particularly what's going on in biotechnology that's turning agriculture into basically a computing problem. And then we're going to talk a little bit about iPlant and how we're endeavoring to solve that problem. So let me just jump in with a little background on TAC. So here in Austin, we have the Texas Advanced Computing Center. We're part of the University of Texas, and we're one of the world leaders in providing really big computing systems. Our flagship system a few years ago that's still up and running was Ranger, that at the time was the fastest open science system in the world, a 63,000 processor machine with 120 terabytes of RAM, did 579 teraflops. Lone Star is sort of our current newest and baddest machine on the floor. It has 23,000 processors, about 44 terabytes of RAM. It's still about number 25 in the world, or it was last year, new list coming out in a couple months. And we're going to be putting out a new machine the end of this year, which we think will be one of the fastest in the world, top five or so, which is going to be around 500,000 cores, a new Dell machine with Intel's Sandy Bridge, now Xeon E5 2680 technology, which is much more informative than Sandy Bridge, and the Intel Mini Integrated Core technology along with Dell. That'll be better than a 10 petaflop machine. And so this being South By, we have to start with cool computing technology. So we bring some really big computers to the table. We do a few other things at TAC. Data visualization and data analysis is a big part of what we do. This 300 megapixel tile display is just a couple of blocks from here on campus. And it's backed up by Longhorn, a 500 GPU 2000 processor system that's the largest remote visualization machine in the world. As you might imagine, with all this visualization capability and computing capability, we end up with a lot of data. And so Corral is our online data system with more than 6 petabytes of replicated disk online at the moment. Ranch, the picture on your right over there, is our tape archive with 16 drives and 8 robots and about 100 petabytes of tape stored. And then finally, TAC has a lot of folks who do software and consulting, really talented people. We have dozens of software packages for science tuned to these sort of large-scale systems. We have about 90 full-time staff working in computational science, and most recently APIs to make all these machines much easier to use. So that's sort of who we are. And so you might ask, what do we have to do with, say, growing corn, which is what this talk is really about, which seems a long way from big visualization and data systems. So first of all, why is it that we care so much about plants? And why did we get into this plant stuff in the first place? And one of the most important reasons to us, or to me personally, is that the calorie demand in the world is sort of exploding. And so I often refer to this slide, some of you have seen, as my self-portrait slide. But you know, we need 1,800 to 2,000 calories a day to support people. In the U.S., we actually produce 3,800 calories per day per person. So about twice is what is needed, and that's a growth from 2,000 to about 4,000 calories a day since about 1978. Not only is the population grown, et cetera, but the per-person consumption has grown pretty dramatically. And that's the sort of spread of the Western supersize me diet. And as that diet spreads around the world, we're going to see some changes in the amount of crops we need. And if you look at the three staple crops, which represent about 70% of the plant production, in the world today, at least the domesticated plant production, you see that you need about a pound of rice, the staple crop in Asia, per person to support the Asian diet. You need about a pound of wheat per day in Europe to support the diet there. And you need about 3.5 times as much in the U.S. in corn. 3.5 pounds a day. In a famous book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan referred to us as tortilla chips with legs, and that's a pretty accurate assessment of people in the U.S. And of course, this is the whole food chain. It's not that we go around eating ears of corn all day. As you might have noticed, it's just that we do this protein-intensive diet, and we tend to process it very inefficiently through cows and chickens to lead to this really, really high demand for plants. And if we were to spread this diet around the world by, say, I don't know, opening McDonald's in China and taking that Western diet and promulgating it around the globe, we'd need the arable acreage with current technology of about 4 Earth-sized planets to feed the world the way we currently feed the United States. So we have this sort of existential dilemma of we either tell the rest of the world they can't have this diet, we change the way we eat in the U.S., probably somewhat unlikely, or we do something about it with technology. So, as I mentioned in the last slide, a huge amount, there's about 24 plants that really matter, that produce 99% of agriculture. There are 500,000 plant species on the planet, and of course the ones that grow easily and fast aren't necessarily the ones that we cultivate. So just a few other trends that are going to drive demand for plants and why this is an important problem besides our incessant need to eat steak is most likely we're not looking at a static population. That 4 Earth-sized planets was based on the static assumption. No change in climate, no change in land use, no change in amount of available water, no change in population. But most likely we are going to see a change in population, and there's various scenarios ranging from prosperity for all to sort of doomsday. But in even the average scenario, we're looking at a steady increase in population. Most of this population increase, the bad thing about exponential curves is, you know, up until 1850, all of human evolution, we were supporting less than 1 billion people, and now we're going to go from 6 to 8 in just a couple of decades. What that's meant for land use is that 10,000 years ago, when we were sort of hunter-gatherers, we had about 10,000 available acres per person. I'm sorry, 6,000 acres per person, so we could support, that's about the land you needed to support an individual and produce enough food for their diet. Today, we're down to about 0.5 acre a person of land under cultivation, and so we need to get to 1/3 acre per person to be sustainable. That's sort of not what's going on. If you look at the land that's under cultivation, it sort of peaked in the 70s and has been dropping ever since with peaks and valleys. Not a smooth trend, but that green area is dropping off, and we probably need that to go back up unless, again, we can do some technological things to make it better. So this is really a technology talk and a technology conference, and as everyone knows, you can't go to a technology talk without a slide about Moore's Law. So one of the reasons this grain area has been dropping is we actually do have Moore's Law for corn. And this is a slide I put together with some database from the USDA, and they kept track of production per acre in every state since about 1866. And if you look at this, and in fact, this is a USDA database, but it was actually flat for that started in 1866, but the amount of corn we could grow on an acre was pretty static from the time we domesticated corn over 1,000 years or so, up until the 1930s. And then we took off on this sort of Moore's Law curve. And, you know, it's just like Moore's Law for silicon, except the period's a little different. We double about every 25 years instead of about every 24 months. But we've had several doublings. And, in fact, in the last 75 years, we've seen an 8x improvement in the amount of corn we can produce on an acre. And the reason for this is the sort of trifecta of modern agriculture. We figured out irrigation. That was a big one. We figured out nitrogen-based fertilizer, bring fertilizer to fields, and we figured out crossbreeding. And through breeding, we've done a great deal to change what crops look like. And in fact, you know, you might have noticed that you've never taken a walk in the woods and run across a wild corn plant growing with a big ear of corn hanging off of it. And the reason is wild corn looks like the thing you see on your left there, which you can still find in hilltops in Guatemala. But the intervention of humans on this plant and the selective breeding we've done have turned it into the corn you're used to, you see on the right. So that's one of the things that has dramatically changed how much we can produce from a crop. The downside of that is we have less available genetic diversity because of all the inbreeding and selective breeding we've done to produce that. So we're much more vulnerable to pests and disease and other things that you get in sort of a genetic monoculture. As a result of that, well, not really so much directly as a result of that, but one of the things we've been seeing recently is that sort of early agricultural technology, crossbreeding, fertilizer, irrigation, that's done so much for us, is starting to give us a flattening curve in this Moore's Law thing. So if you look at the world grain production, this is starting at 1960 or so, you see that starting in about the mid-90s, it looks like the curve is starting to flatten. And in fact, if you take out, this is sort of the percent change per decade, how much progress we're making in agricultural technology, and it looks like it's still been sort of chunking along, but a lot of that is we've been bringing to the developing world a lot of the advantages of modern agriculture. And if you take out the developing world and just look at countries that are doing modern agriculture, you see that each decade there's been less improvement, and in the 90s it's really tailed off, and that's continued. And the result of that is we've kind of done what we can do with the agricultural technology as we knew it. So we need a new generation of agricultural technology, and that's what we're going to talk about. Of course, we have some other demands. We have the demand for bioenergy. And so this is just a graph of how many million tons go into ethanol of U.S. grain. Corn is a grain for purposes of agricultural discussion. So how much corn gets diverted into ethanol production, and how many 100 million people you could feed with that corn on the other side. So that's something that has increased demand. And there's some pretty serious consequences of this, other than the need for us to continue to eat very large steaks. If you look at food prices and what goes on in the world, there's a lot of data that strongly correlates where commodity prices and food are and how much political stability there is around the world. And I personally would track this back to 1792 and let them eat cake. This is an example of what happens when you ignore high food prices. But if you go back to the pre-recession spike in commodity prices in 2006 and 2007, there were food riots all around the world. Egypt had the most violent riots. Then the recession came, prices dropped, things sort of leveled off for a while. But there is a group that actually measures the risk of political instability in food. They put out the Nomura Food Vulnerability Index. And about a year and a half ago, in September 2010, the places that were most vulnerable to political instability due to commodity price spikes in food were Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia. We're all in the top five of candidates. Commodity prices then went up 40% in the 4 months after that report, and about 5 months after that report came out, the Arab Spring started, and governments were toppled in Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia. So there are pretty serious consequences for not being able to produce enough food to keep the prices low. But there's a lot of things we can do about this. So good old-fashioned crossbreeding technology has led to things like this, where if you look at a field of corn, and this was, you know, what we learned in the 30s that started that curve going up, was this is a field of corn if you use an inbred seed, and if you crossbreed two strains of corn, that's the same guy in the same field with hybrid corn. And so that's put us on this 800% improvement. But we still don't really understand the molecular mechanism that causes that, what's called hybrid vigor or heterosis in corn. So it's one of those things we need to understand. So what we know overall, we have this Western diet that's going global. We have these crops that are used for bioenergy is putting more pressure on crops. We have a growing and aging population. We have less with urbanization, less acreage available for agriculture. I didn't even mention climate change, but there's a pressure on water supplies that's doing this. Price increases are going to lead to political instability or have led to political instability. So clearly it's important that we understand plant biology. Let me just wrap up sort of the motivation section here and turn things over to Matt. You have the next slide. If we're going to solve this problem, we need sort of a new level of understanding in plant biology, and that's what's becoming a data-driven and computing problem. And let me let Matt tell you about what's going on in biotech that's making that happen.
So to solve world hunger, from the standpoint of increasing agriculture production, we need to be able to we need a solution to this equation. It's a pretty simple equation. It's three terms: genotype by environment equals phenotype. So by genotype, we just mean the genetic structure of the organism, what its genes are. The environment are both static and dynamic aspects of the environment. So this is everything from climate to long-term climatological shifts, distress, harvesting, herbivory, you name it. The phenotype is just things that we care about. Plant morphology, yield, fruitiness, sweetness, disease resistance. So genotype by environment equals phenotype. However, it's a little bit more complicated than this, because there's thousands of genes, if not hundreds of thousands, in your average species. They interact in networks. The environments are dynamic, and the phenotypes are multiple, and they're also not necessarily independent. So solving this equation becomes a very very daunting task. So step one is to identify all the genes. So it seems like a pretty simple undertaking. To do that, you sequence a genome. So genome sequencing in the previous century was very expensive. So this is just an aerial shot of the floor of a production sequencing facility, probably in the mid to late 90s. So this is armies of people slaving away, probably on the human genome. It cost $100 million at least to sequence the first human-sized genome. It took 4 to 8 years, depending on how you call it, hundreds to thousands of person years and a lot of pearl. Here's some time at the end of 2012. We're going to be able to do this for $900 in 15 minutes with a machine that looks like this. So this is actually something that exists. Whether we get it at the end of 2012 or sometime in 2013, this is where we're going. To contextualize this in terms of a graph, the x-axis is years, the y-axis is the number of DNA bases that can be produced by a top-of-the-line sequencing machine. So you can see things kind of puttered along there in the 90s and early 2000s, and then they hit a pretty substantial spike. That was the introduction of what are called next-generation sequencing machines. But this linear increase is a little bit deceptive because if you look carefully at the y-axis, it's a log scale. So this means these are increasing tenfold each increment. This is crazy. This led to just massive amounts of data. The upsides of this, we can get direct knowledge of species of interest. So we've done crazy things like sequence the woolly mammoth, or sequence Neanderthals, or sequence the ancestor of corn. We can mine biochemical networks directly. We don't have to infer them. We can just go in, rip them out, and actually figure out all of the component pieces. And we can do very precise measurements, even at the cellular level, when this technology is used quantitatively. The downsides of this are their explosion of data. The storage and retrieval has become a nightmare. There's a massive knowledge extraction problem, and the biologists who really didn't sign up for this have become programmers. So on the data storage and retrieval side, I'm going to show you two examples. So example one is one of these large production sequencing facilities, the Sanger Institute. So the top graph is growth in terabytes of their aggregate genome sequence information. So they now have, as of April 2011, they had 12 petabytes of DNA sequence information. You can see the massive uptick there in the mid 2000s. The rate of increase in this graph has tripled since the early part of 2011. They also, so it's not just files though, they also have a 400 terabyte Oracle database. It's one of the largest in the world. Example two is an average lab scientist, so like me. In 2000, I had 150 megs of data found on a zip disk. I packed it in a bag. I took it to do my postdoc. In 2012, I've got 24 terabytes of data, and I don't even sequence genomes directly. What's happened is that a lot of this data, we kind of scrambled finding out where to put it, how to retrieve it, and so there are workflows, literally, I kid you not, that involve going, looking up where the data is stored in an Excel spreadsheet, going, getting the USB hard drive, plugging it in, and reading it out. And that's the level of sophistication that a lot of centers or laboratories have been acting at. The Sanger Institute is a large professionally managed organization, and they've been able to anticipate this a little bit, but they're still constantly feel as though they're being caught flat-footed. So once you capture the data, extracting actual knowledge from it is also complicated. So you guys recognize this type of diagram, probably worked on it maybe last weekend. You've got this genome, this map of the genome, and you want to do two things. You want to identify all the genes, and you want to figure out what do they do. And then you can figure out how they work together. It turns out that it's even hard to figure out what genes are. So When the human genome was completed in 2001, there were two radically different estimates of the number of genes. One was about 30,000, and one was about 150,000. And the current public estimate is between 18,000 and 20,000, so why the variation? Well, it turns out, first of all, that gene structures aren't simple. So this is just a picture showing one region. This is a gene. Unfortunately, this gene doesn't just create one protein. It actually produces 10 gene products, 10 messenger RNAs from the top strand, and 3 from the bottom strand. So is this 4 genes? Is it 13 genes? Is it something in between? We can kind of reason through this because we're intelligent, but try explaining this to a computer in a way where you can process this at high throughput. So while we're on the topic of gene products, we assumed going into this that most genes encoded proteins. But a project called ENCODE actually addressed this hypothesis, and they found out that at least in humans, and this is probably the case in higher plants too, that just 1.2% of the human genome encoded proteins. And yet, most of the genome is transcribed into RNA. And a lot of that RNA is conserved. That means it's under selective pressure. It's doing something. But it doesn't make proteins. So what this means is that the central dogma, which we learned in biology class, DNA, messenger RNA, protein, this is actually just a boundary case. We were kind of lucky to stumble across it, but it's actually the exception rather than the rule. So what do these genes do? It's hard to probe functionally what individual genes do. It's very experimentally intensive. You usually actually have to go and do experiments. So what we rely on is taking educated guesses about what genes are by looking at genes where that's already been done. So if we look at E. coli, 62% of its genes, and that means somebody has gone in and knocked it out or perturbed it or whatever, and they know what over half the genes in E. coli do. About 30% of the genes have been surveyed in yeast, but in Arabidopsis, which is a little model species that's used in plant biology, or rice or maize, those numbers are much, much less. So you infer function by looking across species. This is very computationally intensive to do it the first time. And then you have to constantly be doing this. You have to constantly refresh your analysis every time you sequence a new genome, every time you want to update update your knowledge. You have to run the entire analysis from scratch. This is obviously pretty computer intensive. You also have to be able to not just keep up with the information in your field. So you're an Arabidopsis researcher, you want to keep up with just your data. That's not how it works. You actually have to read very, very widely to the point where it's basically impossible. For instance, something about a gene that you're working on may be discovered in clams. Now, you're not reading about clams every day. You're not subscribed to clams daily. And yet somehow that information has to filter into your computational pipelines.
Does Clams Daily not have a Twitter feed that you can follow?
You still have to extract knowledge out of the Twitter feed.
So I don't see anybody worried about
publications,
that.
And it's basically impossible to keep up just with the printed literature. The number of publications in PubMed just from the U.S. alone are 7.6 million. And then you have publications across the rest of the scientifically productive world. Just in 2009, we probably ought to update this, there are almost 1 million publications. That's 2,300 publications a day. I'm lucky to read a paper each day. So how many papers, theoretically, can you read? You can put grad students on it, et cetera. You're never going to keep up with it. So in addition to all of this sequence generation, there has to be a lot of text mining and automated functional annotation. So the third consequence of this data explosion is that biologists have become developers. So imagine a world, and I know there are a lot of worlds like this, but imagine a world where the whole software ecosystem is made up as you go along in response to really specific requirements. I need to make a graph today, or I need to look at the relationship among some genes, or I need to keep records, or I need to do some plots. And I've never programmed before, and I just happen to have this laptop laying around. What you get are tools that are separated by platform, formats, operational integration. It's just kind of a mess. You still get to your scientific objectives, but it's really, really labor-intensive. It's fragile. That means that you actually can't share your results. You can't share your analytical methods. You kind of write down what you did, but you probably can't actually replicate it yourself, let alone share it with a colleague. This is the state of the art. So, did you get that picture?
Yes.
Okay. It's my favorite slide.
We all like the air conditioning.
So, just to summarize real quickly, the challenges in reading and interpreting just the genetic information have been the exponentially increasing volume of the data, the complexity of knowledge extraction, the reliance on ad hoc software ecosystem. But we face the same issues. Remember, this is just on the genetic data. Interpreting the environment and the phenotype data, we need to balance the other side of the equation. So advances in imaging systems. In about the last decade, serious increases in the sophistication of imaging technologies have been applied to capturing environmental and phenotype information. So we have everything from positron emission tomography to capture the exact location of specific metabolites in an organ to macro scale and field scale multispectral imaging, laser scanning, LIDAR, X-ray tomography. The result of this is that we get really complex data fields as opposed to the relatively simple stuff that you get from genome sequencing. It's just A's, C's, T's, and G's, maybe some graph structures. These are large binary complex matrices. To compound this, we've stuck all of these sequencing or these acquisition technologies on robots. So we've done everything from small experimental lab scale robots, whether they're mounted on arms or mounted in special cabinets, to entire greenhouses that are, you know, half an acre in size, where every plant can be measured and the environment can be controlled very tightly, to the use of unmanned aerial vehicles with massive sensor arrays mounted on them. So phenotyping and environment measurements used to be laborious, so you could easily capture genetic information, but it was hard to get the other side of the equation. But the same advances in robotics, microcontrollers, sensing, imaging, et cetera, that have led to the increase in genetic sequencing information have led to advances in phenotyping. And the result is that there's a complete and total flood of complex binary data. It's probably going to be even more of a challenge than the sequencing information. So we've established that there's a huge amount of work to do in plant science to meet this global demand for food, maybe air, pharma, et cetera. A lot of this work's going to be driven by data and computation. And maybe, just maybe, an advanced computing center ought to do something about that. So we did. Dan?
Thanks, Matt. We are surprisingly on time here. Martin? We specialize in the 120-slide-an-hour talk. So we're going to get done just when we want to. So at this point, you're probably all wondering, why did we choose to talk about this topic at what is effectively a web technology conference in a lot of ways. So we do actually have a project to solve some of these problems using the advanced computing systems we have and to tackle these huge data problems that Matt just alluded to, and that is the iPlant project. And so iPlant is a large-scale effort by the National Science Foundation in the U.S. To build what they call a virtual organization to build a cyber infrastructure to address the grand challenges of plant biology. And we'll define some of these words in a moment. And so we are part of a very large team here at TAC and at UT on this project that includes the University of Arizona and Cold Spring Harbor Labs as the primary participants. And then we have hundreds of members, researchers from around 50 U.S. academic institutions, the USDA, the Department of Energy, and various folks around the world who are tackling these problems. So to pull those worlds apart, cyber infrastructure is not a word that outside the NSF community has taken on a whole bunch of meaning, but it was defined, like most good words that attract funding, it was defined in the last 10 years in a blue ribbon report by the National Academies and the NSF, and finally codified in this cyber infrastructure vision document. And what cyber infrastructure about is tackling science and society's toughest problems through these sort of four pillars: high performance computing, data and data analysis, virtual organizations because we're at the point where the challenges we face, like this one, are sort of on a global scale, and we can't address them with researchers in a single lab at a single institution anymore, and then teaching people something to do things about it. And so that's part of what we set out to do in iPlant. And as you might imagine, one of the early challenges was figuring out exactly what that meant. And so this slide, which has been reused a million times in a million contexts, of six blind guys and an elephant, was originally applied to cyber infrastructure in the NSF's TerraGrid project, which funds the supercomputing centers, now known as the Exceed project. But it applied equally here in iPlant. Is when we started the project, everybody had their own understanding of what cyber infrastructure meant. Is it networking? Is it software tools? Is it web tools? Is it providing large-scale computing? Is it building the storage? What is it? So what iPlant has been about is to figure out what cyber infrastructure means in the context of the big problems in plant science. And another unique thing about iPlant is we were to solve the grand challenges of plant science, but at the time of funding the project, those weren't actually defined. It was to work with the community to figure out what those challenges were, but then to build this infrastructure and to get community buy-in of this vision and execute it. And so what we see this problem as is, obviously, given what Matt just talked about, with all the genomic and phenomic or image data that's out there now, computing is at the central place in life science research as it never has been before, and it's probably on a peer with bench research. And we have this enormous investment in the U.S. in computers for science, like those we have at TAC. We have an enormous investment in collecting this data, order $1 billion in grabbing sequence data at this point. There's a huge amount of bioinformatics tools and a large software investment. And so what we're trying to do is build the infrastructure to let those play together. And there's lots of examples of bioinformatics tools. Matt mentioned the Human Genome Project was about a whole lot of Perl. And that wasn't necessarily the way to build a scalable architecture to solve the problems that we're going to face. So we'll talk a little bit about some examples of that. And there really are some very big problems. One of the grand challenges we settled on was building the tree of life, understanding the origins of key traits in plants like water use efficiency. Why is it kudzu vines grow a foot a day in a drought and corn vines wither and die? Where's the evolutionary basis of that, and can we find that and bring it into other plants? So you do that, one of the ways you do that is by building phylogenetic trees, looking at common ancestors. But the number of trees grows pretty fast, and this is actually a very old estimate, but something where we're at least in the middle of this, we can start to tackle some of these problems. If you start with just three species that you're trying to come up with every possible evolutionary path, you get four trees. At four, you get 15. At 10, you get 282 million. There's 500,000 green plant species on the planet. So brute force approaches, even with the scale of computing we're putting at this, aren't going to work very well. So we need some intelligent software and some heuristics to tackle this. Just to review quickly, the history of iPlant is this is a project that's about 4 years old. So I'm going to show you some of the web tools that we've built. And over the last, really, about 2.5 years, the first year and a half, we were figuring out what is a cyber infrastructure in the context of plants? What are the grand challenges that we're going to tackle? So in 2009, in the fall, we started development. And so we'll show some of those things. And Matt somehow put that slide in twice, so we'll just skip it. So what we've built in the cyber infrastructure is, one, a whole lot of storage and good ways to get to it. We have the iPlant data store is a key way to get to storage. Two, we're going to need to reproduce experiments because it's in so much of scientific computing. When there's a set of Perl scripts built by a grad student in a particular lab who had their brand of sequencer data, they produce a paper that says, I got this result, and no one can figure out how to reproduce that again because the version of glibc on the version of Linux they ran it on changed, and now the answers are a little different, and nobody can assess why. We have sharing and collaboration because, as Matt mentioned, publications at the scale we're doing now of a million publications a year aren't an effective way to get your results out to your colleagues, at least not comprehensively. Visualization, fast workflow construction. We didn't really touch on this very much, but because of the rate of change in sequencers and phenomic things that we measure, the estimate right now is that when you build a workflow in plant sciences, it has about 180-day lifespan, and then you have to build another one. So hardcore software engineering to engineer a pipeline that works isn't going to work when somebody changes out your core data formats or comes up with a better algorithm or changes the way they want to review the results every 180 days or so. So we needed to be very agile, not in the software engineering sense, although we are somewhat, but agile in the sense of being able to bring in new tools quickly. Ability to integrate community algorithms, because we'll never rebuild all that bioinformatics, and to try and point them at very large computer systems and make them scale. So the three components, and let me just skip to the figure here, are at the bottom, we're using the national scale resources funded by the National Science Foundation at places like TAFT, very large scale computers, databases, cloud systems, very large scale storage systems. On top of that, we use sort of best practice middleware that we're reusing, iRODS, for instance, the rule-oriented data system, for building out the data store, standard authentication mechanisms, and things of that nature. At the level above that, we've built web APIs, and we decided in a community that where has some C++ programmers, but an awful lot of Perl hackers and shell scripters and a Python Grr sub-community and an R sub-community and everything else, the web is the common structure. So all the interfaces through the APIs are RESTful. We use REST to access all the resources through our APIs. And then on top of that, we have what actually faces the community, which are some web portals we build and also a lot of web portals that other folks build and even people just building their own scripts for their labs and embedding REST calls to fetch data, et cetera. So the major sort of end user points to get to that are we have what's called the Atmosphere platform where we just host those applications that really need, where the only level of abstraction to reproduce what goes on is the virtual machine, to host them in their own OS instance for persistent things and persistent data sets. We have our data, the iPlant data store, which will take all data from petascale to megabytes and everywhere in between. The discovery environment, which I'll demo for you in just a moment, is our web interface. We have a social networking interface to get people together around the species they're working on and collecting data on. We have a teaching interface in DNA Subway, and then of course we have people who come in and use the API directly or just come in at the command line to the big systems. So the data store was one of the real tricks because we have all sorts of levels of sophistication in terms of the interfaces people want. Some people wanted the very easy interface, you know, the web dev style thing or just a drag and drop or a fuse client over HTTP. Of course, then you have a lot of people dealing with files much bigger than you can transfer over HTTP effectively into multiple gigabytes where you need multi-socket connections, et cetera. So we settled on as having a coherent data store that appears correctly in our web interface, in a Fuse client, exposed through the API, exposed through things called iCommands and iRODS for very high-speed data transfers, and putting a very simple set of ACLs on there so that people can share the way they want to share. So they can build their own research data sets and only share things after publication, but beforehand share with members of their research team, et cetera. I mentioned the Atmosphere project, which again is essentially our cloud instance. We're hosting about 60 different sort of one-off bioinformatics application sites for various folks, et cetera, become very popular in sort of teaching instances where people have their own stack or people trying to support a fairly complex stack. We have one customer who has around that phenotyping software that Matt mentioned, an image processing stack, who's spending an inordinate amount of time getting people to build the 12 or 15 packages on their own boxes to support that. Now he just points them at images where people click and run his image with everything pre-installed. And then we have the discovery environment. And so this is a rich web client of all the best practice of many of the web clients you're hearing about at the conference. It, you know, is designed to provide a fairly consistent interface to that sort of disconnected set of interfaces and tools that Matt mentioned before. It keeps you from having to interact directly with APIs and lower level things, so it's really focused on end users. But most importantly, it's extensible because of that 180-day lifespan of workflows. You can add your own tools and data and workflows to it, originally through JSON descriptions, JavaScript object notation, now through little web wizards, and I'll show you a demo of that. We can bring in tools, and this is from last September, where we brought in a visualizer. This is the EFP browser by Nick Privard at the University of Toronto. It's a great tool, but you had to install and configure it yourself, or you had to figure out how to get your own data into his web service for it. We pulled it into the discovery environment, working with Nick, in 38 minutes at a workshop, hackathon type thing. So now, if you have your data sources in the discovery environment and you want to throw them out to EFP, it's all on a consistent web interface. And again, not everything is done in the discovery environment. There's a bunch of different applications that sit on top of those APIs. So many talks over the last 2 days have stressed the API is really the key to our infrastructure as well. And there are a number of things like the BioExtract portal, the Gates Integrated Breeding Platform, the Arabidopsis Informatics resource, the CoExpression browser that sit on top of the API. And on top of that, we've even built some in-house bioinformatics tools to make things scale, like browsers that can actually deal with 500,000 species. So before we end, let me just do a very quick movie of what goes on in the discovery environment for a couple of real scientists and how we're tackling this. So Lin here is Lin Wang is a postdoc at Cornell. He works for Tom Brutnell in a fairly famous sequencing lab. They work on corn, curiously enough, on maize problems. And in his particular thing, he was looking at some gene regulatory networks. You can read the details. He was using a package called Tuxedo that was developed for analyzing the human genome. And immediately he ran into some problems because of some species differences. And he found out that one particular part of the package didn't work very well. Have the sensitivity he needed in the aligner phase. So he got rid of the bow tie aligner and wrote his own native aligner. But now he had this custom Perl script, this is very common in bioinformatics, that fit into this complicated pipeline and no real way to distribute that to the community. So he asked us, how can I share my code out with the users of iPlant? And so we said, hey, you take your Perl script and you add it to our discovery environment. And the clumsy interface, see if I can actually hit play at the right time. And so he went in, this is sped up a little bit, but found his tool from the list of available tools. You install it on the back end, have it there, gives it a descriptive name, and in this case, because nobody cares if you're running BWA 1.4.6 when you're the end user, he called it the Brutnell Lab RNA-seq pipeline, because his advisor is a fairly famous guy, and people would know about the Brutnell Lab pipeline. Then we go through and model the command line. This is a Unix command line script. Normally, these are the kind of tools we bring in, and we're building out through a set of wizards here the interface to it. Here, select reference genome. Under the hood, that's a dash G. It should come from the reference sequence database that we have available online, so it'll give users a set of choices for that. And then we're setting up inputs and outputs as we go through here. This is a slightly dated screenshot. The interface looks a little different now, but it all pretty much worked the same. This is from about August. But you can see very quickly, and I'm going to put the command line parameters now. We can describe this whole command line and even do a few things that you wouldn't get if you were working at the command line. We're adding validation, so for this dash D parameter, we're saying it's a number. We're giving it a default to try and get the user moving in the right direction if they didn't know that 1,000 is a good sensitivity to use. We put that in there. So we give it tooltip discussions. We give it a description. And in fact, we even have validation rules down at the bottom of the screen there. So you can say it's a number, it's an integer, it has to be positive, it has to be less than 2,000, and flag users before they start with all the validation rules they need. And so going on, publishing it, you set up the command line, you drag and drop to put your groups of parameters in the right order, you get a demo of what the command line would look like. You can take these parameters that have defaults, you can hide them, you can expose them. If you want to just set things for a particular application, you're saying this is the corn pipeline, this number should always be this for corn genomes. You don't even have to expose it in the interface. You can have the same tool in multiple ways to give users however level of control or ease of use that you want, from one button to many buttons. You end up by saying publish, and you come over here to the production discovery environment. You started out in a sort of unvetted category in progress. There's the Brutnell Lab RNA-seq pipeline immediately available in the web interface. You send to your friends, hey, go look in the in-progress tools. It's called this. And they can start running it. And here, in fact, we're picking the reference genome, aligning it against the Arabidopsis thaliana version 10 genome. There's all your form and parameters filled out with defaults, giving it a name for the demo, clicking OK. And the end gets submitted to a large-scale resource on the back end. So you're probably going to screw that up once or twice in real life. That's the four-minute version of it. In fact, you'd probably sit down and spend about 45 minutes putting it in there. But now we have multiple different methods in the discovery environment to do RNA-seq work, which is what Lin's doing, that are perhaps sequence-specific, lab-specific, that are specific to this publication that you can go in and reproduce. So we have sort of a marketplace of ideas, almost an app store concept, in the discovery environment for building different methods. One last example. So we're going to do, again, pretty common problem nowadays is people move off reference species and everybody's working in the plant of choice. Since we're in Texas, we're going to look at the draft assembly of the transcriptome, so what actually gets transcribed from the genome of the H. texanum flower, a local flower here in Texas. So this is a genome that's part of the 1,000 Plant Transcriptome Project, which happens to store its data with iPlant. We have 11 million 100 base pair long RNA reads from one of those sequencers that we have to align. So these are, you know, this is a pretty typical research question, and it has a pretty complicated workflow, and some parts of it are big. The actual assembly piece is a computationally intense thing. Hundreds of gigabytes of RAM, you know, hundreds to thousands of hours of processing. So we're going to do that on TAX Ranger supercomputer here. Assessing the contigs that come out of that, what overlapped, how long are those things? Pretty easy script. Something you wouldn't want to wait through a queue to run. You're going to do filtering, also a pretty easy utility type thing. Then we're going to run BLAST against a reference sequence to try and do the aligning. And again, massive computational problem. We want to do that on Ranger. And then compile the annotation results on Ranger. So we have some easy things to do, some things that need a supercomputer, five different tools that we need to run to make this work. So traditionally, this is where biologists, as Matt had mentioned, become bioinformaticians. So you call somebody who knows Unix, and you sit down and run this set of tools. We've made this fairly easy. And I don't want to go too long, so let me just play a few seconds of this. But all of those tools have been put into the discovery environment. We can now, in fact, save them in a pipeline. But in this case, we'll run them by hand. So you could go to whichever tool we want to run, kick off, say, the assembler. Interesting thing here that we'll go by quickly, this is that interface that came through tool integration. All demos have bugs, even in the movies, so there's a little error message there as it pulls up reference genomes. But when we go to assembly options, a bad question to ask biologists is how many processors do you need? So they're filling out some biological specific questions here, giving it a name. We'll go down to run options, and we still ask them for how many days, how many hours do you think this thing is going to run? But then for job size, we asked them, is this a single or multiple flow cell transcriptome, and a few other questions like that, rather than do you need 64 or 512 processors? And based on what they answer, we actually, for this particular job, run between 64 and 1,024 based on the set of choices they make. And so in this case, we've clicked submit. It's been the discovery environment, and this is just the truth part. We're actually going to log in to Ranger and go through show queue and see the 128 processor size test problems actually running and submitted in the queue. And so all of the various steps happen, if I were to let this movie play, from within the discovery environment. It uses several different back-end resources. They never know they're moving machines. They never know they're moving data. It's all relatively transparent. And in fact, the more modern problems with the modern discovery environment screenshot, this is just from code we released in January. We can do what we call high throughput inquiry, where we take this problem, run three different transcriptomes with three different algorithms on three different resources around the country, the Ranger and Lone Star systems at TAC, the Blacklight system at the Pittsburgh Supercomputer Center. Shared memory, some algorithms run better on that. Meanwhile, pulling annotation from the European Bioinformatics Institute via REST web service to annotate that in the UK, all from, again, within this web client. So last message, not even going to do the demo, but there are, as I mentioned earlier, some really big scalable problems in biology. And there are real problems with tools. So this is a real data set from some folks at Iowa State looking for just interaction on pairs of locations in the genome and what happens with epigenetics. Visualization by Matt, by the way, on this particular slide. But this was their data set. They had 1,100 markers in the genomes they were going to look at. There's 3 billion, so you could do a much harder problem here. 13,000 molecular phenotypes, behaviors they were looking at, and 56 species in their test set that they'd actually grown plants for and built the data. So they wrote an R script to solve this problem, as is the want of bioinformatics. And the estimated runtime for it was 1,634 years, which is longer than most grad students are willing to wait to get their PhD for an answer. So it's one where we helped them out with code and got it down to 4.5 hours on 128 processors. Now, for those of you who know SpeedUp, that's a little bit superlinear, so it's not just the parallel computer helping there. And in this case, getting out of R got us to make the thing run about 1,000 times faster. It tells you the mismatch between some of these scripting languages and the performance that's actually available on the machines. Doing cache block code optimization, so the level of wizards, not biologists for the most part, got another 25x, and then we got about 125x out of the parallelism for a SpeedUp of 3 million. But there is a big gap between the average Perl script and what we can really do on a big machine. So the takeaways, we're building this cyber infrastructure around plant biology. We have a couple of hundred tools that work in it now for different problems. We have a lot of computing and storage available, but yeah, I didn't really want to focus on specific tools that we have in there now, because it's not about a particular set of tools, because those constantly change. It's about building the future of bioinformatics a little bit differently and to build things that work together. So back to our existential question. We either need to use supercomputers to do better plant science, or we all need to give up cheeseburgers once and for all to support life on Earth. So I've picked supercomputers and work night and day on this problem so that we never have to give up cheeseburgers. So in the future of bioinformatics, we want to see less of this and more of this. So thanks very much, and we'll stop there. So we've left about 10 minutes for questions, if anybody has any. Or you could maybe still catch the tail end of Al Gore's talk, if you hurry. So, on webcast. So. Or happy hour could start now. Yes, sir.
I hope I didn't miss this, but have you integrated with any publishing platforms so far where this data is exposed, like alongside journal articles?
We have not. We have a lot of support to do that, but we haven't struck a deal with publishers. And we're actually counting on the journal publishers to sort of lead the way on requirements for that. But what we do is any data object in the data store, we can generate a unique URL around. For any other object in the system, like workflows, we can generate a unique URL around. So we could say, you know, in the end of a publication, here's the URL for the data, here's the URL for the workflow that generated the data. But for us to ever enforce that, we get very close to that. We're the government. We're here to help you. So, but we don't think we ever have the right levers in the research community to do that. We, however, people who get to say yes or no on your journal publications have a lot more levers in that regard. So we'd love to work with some publishers to do exactly that kind of thing. So it's to say, hey, in order for you to publish here, stick your data in the iPlant data store, make your tools available through iPlant. You know, we don't want to be heavy-handed about that, obviously, but have it as a method. And then we can generate and store permanent DOIs or URLs around reproducing that data in the long term. So that's definitely the kind of partnerships we're interested in.
So you've had success in getting folks to upload their code and have it easier to run. Have you had success in, besides just collaborating or people discovering new tools on there and using them?
I'm sorry.
So I would say at this point, I can't point to a success where because of our infrastructure, there's been a new collaboration formed, except with us and within the project and as a result of some meetings we've had. But biology at the moment, plant biology, is a very collaborative field. And there's a lot of people working together on grants. You know, as you might imagine, we have a lot of people putting in proposals to come talk to us about provisions for using the infrastructure, something around 100 different projects we talked to last year. And they almost are always cross-institution partners in various different places. Matt's involved in a few that he might want to talk about. And what we've done, what we have seen is we've helped enable some of those pre-existing collaborations of two guys. I mean, researchers meet at a conference, hey, we're working on these similar things. Let's get together and do a follow-up proposal. How are we going to deal with that? And those are the kind of problems I think we're helping with. So we may not be starting the collaborations, but we're making them smoother. Be responsible.
So something else I'd like to add is that we actually don't have to know what everyone's doing on the system. And I'm actually surprised when I look in the logs, the amount of activity that's going on in the discovery environment. And I assume that some of those are collaborative activities. But they're people that I've never heard of, that I've never interacted with, they've never posted in the forums, and yet they're in there and they're successfully doing science. And I think that's actually a hallmark of a successful infrastructure project, is that people are simply on board and using it.
The other possibility is someone has figured out how to use the discovery environment to send spam, but we're not aware of that yet.
Or to sequence spam.
Yeah, or sequence spam. Do we have metrics on the website at this point on usage? We have metrics.
We have metrics, and we're tracking per application metrics. Actually, that's a serious carrot to offer to developers, is that we can show you not just how many times your application was used, but the entire demographic breakdown, funding structure of the users. But we're not...
A few privacy issues of that with researchers, but so we track everything and the provenance of everything, you know, just to help people reproduce workflows and do debugging as much as anything. I don't think we have a great interface to share that out yet, but we do have all the data.
Mm-hmm.
So. Mike behind you there.
Yeah. How portable is the interface? I mean, you've gone through a lot of development, and I'm wondering if somebody wanted to do iCow instead. I mean, would they be able to.
So, funny you ask.
Yeah. Funny you ask. We've had calls about iCattle, or iAnimal more broadly, but with cattle genome folks. You learn lots of interesting things in biology. There's a whole chicken community and cattle community and songbird community and zebrafish, which I still don't understand, but there is a zebrafish community. And all of them are interested in that kind of thing. So right now we can clone off, you know, sort of custom interfaces, custom skins to this for various folks. The whole thing is open source, but it's, you know, it's a big web distributed system. So it's, what, 56 projects in GitHub associated with this. You know, it's all written. The web interface that you see here is primarily in a Google Web Toolkit, GWT. So it is theoretically somewhat reproducible. A project for this year is to get it to the point where we have a sort of discovery environment, clone and build yourself guide of, yes, you need an Apache server, and you need the Google Web Toolkit code, and you need a backend data store it can talk to, and you need a NoSQL database for storing config stuff, and all the various components that you have to set up. So we haven't done a good job of documenting that. We've just put the code out there for folks to use, but that is definitely on the roadmap, and we are going to have clones of this. There is an iAnimal website right now, which just shows you this with iAnimal on the top. There's not much customization at this point, but we are going to do some custom versions of it around various communities.
I'd say clonable and portable with help.
Yeah.
But quite tractable.
We're sort of friendly, so that might help on the help part. So. All right, we're about at our hour. So any last question? So thanks for picking us over Al Gore. We're deeply touched.